Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31. I got my microphone back, my usual one, so I'll be able to get this lecture online pretty fast. The other recorder, I still have to work to figure out how to get that out of the MP3 player onto the internet, but I can do that over the weekend, I think. All right, so let's dim some of these lights like that. Turn this other light off like that. Is that how we usually do it? A little bit like that? Okay, works for me. Let's take a look at the schedule. But before we do, don't forget, sign-in sheet is going around. I forgot last time, but I didn't forget this time, so pay attention, take a look, find that answer sheet, sign-in sheet, before you leave sometime today. Okay, so here is the schedule. Today is the 25th of February, indeed. So the Wednesday labs are getting a practicum, their first practicum, and the morning group took it. The afternoon group still has to take it after lecture. And in lecture, we're going to talk about appendicular skeleton. And then next week, we're going to talk about joints and skeletal muscle. So we're going to move out of skeleton and get into some muscle next week. All right, so today is 25th, Wednesday. So 1 week from today is the 4th. The week from that is the 11th. And then over the weekend, that Monday, the 16th, that is your second lecture exam. So how far away is that? Two and a half weeks away. All right, and we're finishing up these chapters right now. We're in eight. Yeah, so we'll have time to finish all these other ones here. Notice that I have two lectures planned for some of these muscles. So we got a lot of lecture before this next exam. One thing I didn't do that I just remembered, I didn't reprogram the quizzes in this next chunk of online quizzes so that it shows you what answers you have chosen. All right, so maybe you've taken an online quiz and it's not showing you the whole thing. I got to go back and reprogram those so that you can see what answers you selected and whether it was right or wrong. Right now I think you only get your score. You don't know maybe even what question you got wrong. I'll have to go back and reprogram those. If by over the weekend I haven't done it, go ahead and send me an email just to remind me. I won't get my feelings hurt if you remind me to go and do that. Okay? All right, so that's the lecture schedule. Anybody have a question on the lecture schedule? We're going over your lecture exams in lab. I don't have enough time in lab this time to have everybody look at their lecture exams, but you can come and see me during my office hours or in lab next time. That's fine, but everybody should look at their Scantron with the answer key for the lecture exam just to get a sense of what's happening there. All right, so I don't see any hands for schedule. Yeah, this should be pretty clear, especially Blackboard runs pretty smooth. All right, so the slide on the right-hand side, all right, that is our skeleton. I've shown you this before, and you see that the skeleton has basically two colors to it, so we can group all the bones in the body into these two general categories. And the gray represents, oh, this is a good question, because here is a question that's not labeled on this slide. A lot of times I ask you a question that's already labeled on the slide, but not here. What part of the skeleton is in gray? It's one of two. Yeah, it's one of two main areas. This is the axial skeleton, including the skull, vertebral column, sternum, and rib cage. We're done talking about all that stuff, so we're going to move on to appendicular skeleton, which is shown in this tan. I think maybe we agreed on tan color last time. All right, so we don't want to say arm, because arm is a little misleading, right? Because this over here, what I'm pointing to between your elbow and your wrist, that's not your arm. That's your forearm, right? So the best way to talk about this whole thing sticking out over here is your upper appendage. This whole thing down over here is your lower appendage, because we want to be really specific when we say arm, forearm, thigh, leg, all that kind of stuff. All right. So we're going to start talking about appendicular skeleton. We're going to talk about the upper appendage first. Just one last thing before we start talking about some of these individual bones. There are things that attach the appendicular skeleton to the axial skeleton. And these things are what we call girdles. And a girdle is just something that surrounds an object 360 degrees all the way around. That's a girdle. And for instance, if you were a forester and you wanted to actually just kill a tree, you can take the bark off of the tree But in order to do that, to kill the tree, you have to, they call that girdling. Just take the bark off in a complete circle. It doesn't have to be a very wide band, but they have to take the bark off in a whole circle. They call that girdling a tree, right? So a girdle is something that surrounds everything. All right, so the upper appendage, the girdle, is made up, and I can see it here and over here, two bones, the clavicle and the scapula. We're going to call this the pectoral girdle. That's where we're going to start our lecture today. And the lower appendage is attached to the axial skeleton with the pelvic girdle. And it's just there's just one bone on one side. We're going to call that the adtaxa. All right, so next week in lab, we're going to start looking at the bones of the appendicular skeleton. And we might only have one lab for these bones. So let's start paying attention to some of these bones. So I'm going to put axial skeleton away and start moving into appendicular skeleton. I don't have very extensive word notes for this one, but okay, here it is right here. And I'll try to follow along with this outline a little bit. All right, so I see two bones. I see the clavicle. What is the common name for clavicle? What do we call that sometimes? Collarbone, yeah. And because I guess we have a shirt collar right there, you could probably call it maybe a girdle bone, but I don't think anybody's ever called it a girdle bone, right? Collarbone, that's the clavicle. And you see it's kind of S-shaped. And that's the first one. The second bone that makes up the pectoral girdle is the scapula. All right, and as we're looking at the scapula right here, what side of the scapula are we looking at? Yeah, it's a little bit misleading. We're looking all the way through the thoracic cavity, looking at the anterior surface of the scapula. So the scapula is a little bit of a weird-shaped bone, and in lab, I want you to pick that scapula up, turn it around, rotate it, turn it upside down, backwards, and put it on your body the way that it should exist. Right? If you can place it on your body the way it should exist, then I think you'll have a really good idea where all the different sides of a scapula are. All right, so getting back to the clavicle, we don't have to know too much about the clavicle, all right, but here is the sternal end. Here is the acromial end. This process on the scapula is called the acromion process, and so this end attaches to the acromion, and this end over here attaches to the manubrium. All right, so sometimes we call that the clavicular manubrial joint, and on this illustration, it looks like the acromial end and the sternal end are pretty similar, right? They both kind of flare out. They get a little bit wider as you get to the epiphysis of this bone. But in lab, you're going to see that these two ends look vastly different from each other. And that's really a good example of why you have to come to lab and look at these 3D structures in order to appreciate that. Because in lab, you're going to see that this acromial end is flat. It almost reminds me of the vomer a little bit, but it's a little bit thicker, but it's flat. It's more like a knife blade. And the sternal end over here looks like the opening of a trumpet or a clarinet. It flares 360 degrees, right? So it really flares out in all directions. So would a knife blade look different than a horn? Yeah, in three dimensions, easy to tell. But if you're just looking from top-down view, they kind of look similar. So don't get tricked by that. And so here is some tubercles right here for ligaments that help attach it to the acromion process. And the shape of this bone is pretty special. Notice that it's wedged very tightly between the acromion process and the manubrium. The manubrium and scapula don't move very much. So if you sustain a hard blow to the shoulder, the clavicle has nowhere to go. And it has a tendency to fracture as a result of that. If somebody falls and hits their shoulder, right, that can break the clavicle. Athletes can break this thing all the time, right, because it just can't give when it's hit hard from the side. And there's a big blood vessel that goes right underneath the clavicle. And take a guess what the name of that blood vessel is. It goes underneath the clavicle. It is called subclavian, the subclavian. So again, I wouldn't expect you really to know that, but after I mention it, maybe it sort of makes sense, right? Subclavian means underneath the clavicle, and if that blood vessel is ever lacerated, since it's so huge, you'd probably hemorrhage to death very quickly as a result. So the shape of this clavicle is kind of noteworthy because when it fractures, because of the shape, it always fractures to the outside, exteriorly. Right? If it were to fracture interiorly, then it would rip that blood vessel apart. Right? And so fortunately, that doesn't happen. And so that kind of explains why we have this S shape, or partly explains why we have the S shape to this clavicle right here. All right, so the subclavian. So again, get to know your bones, because then you learn a lot of neuroanatomy, vascular anatomy, muscle anatomy, all at the same time. Oh, I tell you what. I said that this acromial end, if we look at it from an anterior posterior view, it looks kind of flat. Ah, you know what? I never noticed this before, but look how flat it is when we have just an anterior view of it, as opposed to this top-down view. All right, and again, right, notice that the sternal end also flares out, which we don't see on the acromial end over here. So really, this really looks like the opening of a trumpet or a clarinet. Right? This just kind of looks like a knife blade. So this is going to be lateral. This is going to be medial. All right, so that's part of the girdle. Which girdle are we talking about? Pectoral girdle. Right? So the other bone we want to talk about is the scapula. And the scapula is in the back. That has a lot of bony features to it. Oh, there's that nice clavicle. Has a lot of bony features to it because we have a lot of muscles that attach to the scapula, so that we have a lot of dexterity with our shoulder joints. Right? We can move our arm around in all kinds of different ways. We're going to start talking about the motion of certain kinds of joints. The shoulder is one of the most freely movable joints in our body, so it has a lot of different kinds of muscles, and some of those muscles attach to a whole bunch of different places on the scapula. So here is the scapula. It kind of looks like a triangle. All right, so here is like the base of the triangle, and then here is the point of the triangle, but it's not standing like a pyramid, for instance. All right, and then I see a little depression. What do we call a depression in anatomy? A fossa, right? And so here it's labeled glenoid cavity, but you could call it glenoid fossa, and maybe even more people in the world call it the glenoid fossa than glenoid cavity. Either one is fine with me. Right? And this glenoid cavity articulates with the humerus. Right? So here I see the humerus kind of just drawn out to the side. The head of the humerus articulates. Right? So what side of the scapula is this? Is this going to be medial or lateral? Yeah, it's going to be lateral because your arm attaches right here, which means then this opposite side is going to be the medial side. This is the one that goes up and down the spinous processes on your back. All right, so lateral, medial, to get you oriented a little bit. Okay, so, and it's labeled on the slide. So here is an angle, right? So here's the superior angle, here is the inferior angle, and here is the lateral border. I see a little bump right here that we're going to talk about, and then there's going to be a corresponding little bump. What do we call a bump on a bone? It's a process. Yeah, you could call it protuberance. It's a tiny, tiny little process. They call that a tubercle, but it's a process for muscle attachments and muscles that you're going to love attach right here. All right, and so here is the superior. So we got what? Medial border, lateral border, superior border. Sometimes in the superior border, there is this, well, what do we call it? A structure that kind of looks like somebody took a bite out of it. A notch, right? So here is the suprascapular notch. Supra means on top of. So that's also a nice landmark. All right, so we are looking at the scapula as we would see it on this skeleton. All right, so we're looking through the thoracic cage. We're looking through the thoracic cage and seeing the scapula. So what side of the scapula does this look like here? Anterior. That would be your two choices, anterior or posterior, right? Because there's lateral, there's medial, superior, and inferior. So this is the anterior part of the scapula. This is the part of the scapula that you never see. If you get a back rub, you can't ever rub this part, the muscle that is in here, because it's underneath the scapula. It's protected by the scapula. Nonetheless, it is a depression. And what do we call a depression once again? A fossa. And the function of a fossa is to just hold something. And what this fossa holds is a muscle. Right? And the name of this fossa, and you can see right here, is the subscapular fossa. And now you know the name of the muscle that is in this fossa, and it's called the subscapularis. Right? So a lot of these things will start making a whole lot of really nice, easy sense for you. Subscapular fossa is on the anterior side of the scapula. Right? We talked about this glenoid fossa. Here are some very large, very prominent processes sticking off of the superior angle, which is this lateral angle over here. This big one, which forms the point of your shoulder that you can palpate, this is the acromion process. And maybe if you remember labeling the regions of the mannequin for that first test, that area on your body is what we call the acromial region, because you have the acromial process right there. All right, and it's big and huge. So what can you tell me about the function of this acromial process? What attaches here? Dainty, weak muscles, or many strong muscles? That's right, many strong muscles. Here is one that kind of looks like a beak on a bird. We call that the coracoid process. So coracoid process and acromion are two different ones, but they help stabilize, right, the shoulder joint. So that's a pretty good view of the anterior part of the scapula. So here is the posterior part. This is the one you're most familiar with. Right, so here again is that acromion process. That's the one that makes the tip of your shoulder that you can palpate. And notice where it comes from. It comes from this very prominent ridge of bone that goes all the way from medial border over here to the lateral border. This is what we call the spine of the scapula. And that's easy to palpate on everybody. I'm feeling mine right here. Get a back rub. That's an important landmark, right? Because there's a fossa that's above it. There's a fossa below it. What do we call above something? Supra. What do we call below something? Infra, like supraorbital foramen, infraorbital foramen, for instance. Okay, but these are fossa. So because this is the spine of the scapula, here is the supraspinous fossa, and below the spine is the infraspinous fossa. And now you know the names of two more muscles that you're going to really like. The one up over here is the supraspinatus. The one down over here is the infraspinatus. So again, bones will really make your life a lot easier the more familiar you become with them. All right, so once again, here is that long border. And where is this pointing, laterally or medially? Okay, yeah, it's a little tricky, right? A little tricky. What's your landmark that you want to look for? The glenoid fossa, or maybe this acromion? And where is the glenoid fossa pointing? It is pointing laterally, because that's where your arm attaches, right? So that's a really perfect example. So if this is the lateral part, right, here's a lateral border of the scapula, and this has to be the medial border. All right, so grab somebody, you know, and actually palpate their back, and actually you can feel these different parts of the scapula. They're easy to palpate. All right, so what side of the scapula is this? Is it anterior or posterior?
Posterior.
Yeah, posterior, right? It's a posterior, but since it's on your back, that's the most superficial part of the bone, right, that you can palpate very easily. All right, so the scapula and the clavicle then participate to make what kind of structure in our mind? What are we going to call that? The pectoral girdle, right? And the pectoral girdle are bones that attach your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. All right, now what are some bones of the axial skeleton that I see right here? Okay, we got skull, got vertebral column. Okay, I said the pectoral girdle attaches this upper appendage to your axial skeleton. So does this pectoral girdle attach to your skull? No, it's part of your axial skeleton. What about cervical vertebrae? No, you don't have any arm up over there. What about thoracic vertebrae? And if we zoom in, we'll see that it is not attached to the thoracic vertebrae or the lumbar vertebrae. And there even isn't a joint between the pectoral girdle and any of the ribs. The only joint that attaches the pelvic girdle and hence your upper appendage to your axial skeleton is this one right here, right? The manubrial clavicular manubrial joint. Just a tiny little joint right here is the only thing that's responsible for attaching your whole upper appendage to your axial skeleton. Right, and the reason why we can get away with that is because you have so many muscles that work across the shoulder joint, right? And we just talked about three, but we're going to learn a whole bunch of other ones, right? And for example, we'll learn about the biceps brachii. I'm sure you've heard of that one. Triceps brachii, probably some people have heard of the triceps before. Those are big, strong muscles, right, that will help attach your upper appendage to the pectoral girdle. All right, so that is scapula, along with the clavicle, make the pectoral girdle. All right, so how many fossa did we talk about so far? I'm going to go back to this slide. How many fossa did we talk about for the scapula? And the reason why I'm asking that is because it's a trick question. It has a really obvious, easy answer, but until you see the easy, obvious answer, it's a trick question. So how many fossa did we talk about? Okay, name one for me. Glenoid fossa. Oh, I like starting there best. Glenoid fossa. What's another one? Infraspinous fossa. Supraspinous fossa. That's three. And? Subscapular fossa. So there are four important depressions or fossa on the scapula, and you should be able to point them out. I see two on this slide. I see the supraspinous, I see the infraspinous, and I see the glenoid fossa. And if we flip it over, we can see the subscapular fossa, or all four. All right, but there is another view where we can see all four at the same time, right? Which is this view right here. We're looking at the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa. So what view is this? Is this a medial or a lateral view? Lateral, right? Because the glenoid fossa is pointing laterally. And what can I see? Subscapular fossas? Where did that come from? Go away. Okay, so here is the subscapular fossa. Here is the infraspinous fossa, supraspinous fossa, and glenoid fossa. And look how deep these fossa are, right? The subscapular, infraspinatus, supraspinatus. You really didn't get an impression how deep these fossa were when we just were looking at the previous views. So there are what? Really strong muscles that are held in these locations. All right, so we see 1, 2, 3, 4 fossa. All right, so what bone of the appendage attaches to the scapula? It is this one right here, right? It's a nice long bone. And I heard somebody say humerus, and you're exactly right. So here is the humerus. It's a nice typical long bone. And what are the ends of a long bone called once again? The epiphyses, right? So here's the proximal epiphysis because it's connected to the scapula. Here's the distal epiphysis. And they look a lot different than each other. And so we're actually lucky because it's easy to tell the epiphyses from each other. The proximal epiphysis has a dome-shaped structure. It's almost like a sphere. And if you palpate it, it's going to be really nice and smooth. Right? When it forms a joint, it's covered with hyaline cartilage. And we call this the head of the humerus. How does this attach to the scapula? Can you put that together in your mind? Where does this head of the humerus attach to the scapula? In the side, the glenoid cavity. That's right. Okay. And the glenoid cavity has articular cartilage in it as well. So that's a nice functioning joint. Here are a couple processes. Here's one that is lateral. Here's one that's a little bit medial, and there's a depression that runs between them. These are what we call tubercles. The big one is the greater, the small one is the lesser tubercle. And these are on the anterior side of the humerus. Right? So you might be able to palpate these, depending on how big your deltoid muscle is. Right? You might be able to palpate that. And the little ridge, maybe the ridge between them, you can see. And what do we call a long depression? It's a sulcus, but it's long. Long and narrow. A long and narrow depression is called a sulcus, or you could call it a groove. Groove or sulcus, same thing. Right? So here is, and it's, since it's between the tubercles, we call that the intertubercular sulcus or intertubercular groove. Notice how I had to slow down to say intertubercular. Going to have to practice that too. But that's okay because you want to know how to spell it, right, in lab. All right, so here is the head. Now, when we looked at a rib, we saw the head, which is the enlarged tip of a rib. And then what was right next to the head on a rib? So the head was really big, and then the rib kind of narrowed down. We call that the neck. Yeah. And so the humerus has a neck as well. So here is a little narrowing of that proximal epiphysis. This is what we call the anatomic neck. We call it anatomic because it is smaller than the head, but it's still a pretty massive part of a bone, and it rarely fractures at this location. Right, where the humerus likes to fracture is in this thinner region over here. And this is what we call the surgical neck. It's someplace on one of these slides. I don't see it on this slide. Maybe if I look, I could see it. But here is the surgical neck. Here is the anatomic neck. And surgical neck is because when you break a humerus, right, to reset it requires some surgery, right? So surgical neck. Then we have this big long shaft. What's another name for shaft of a long bone? Yeah, diaphysis, right? So here's a diaphysis. Here's a nice process that's mid-diaphysis. And which way is it pointing? Is it pointing medial or laterally? And how on earth are you going to see that really easily and quickly? Okay, I heard lateral, and I like it, because which way is the head of the humerus pointing? Is it pointing laterally? No, you can't, because there's nothing out there to attach to, right? It's got to be pointing medially. So here is the medial side of the humerus. Here is the lateral side. So this deltoid tuberosity is going to be facing more laterally. And that's an important, and it's a process. What's the function of a process once again? Muscle attachment. And I bet you could tell me the name of the muscle that attaches right here. It is the deltoid muscle. All right, so that makes life pretty easy. A lot of times these things are just named after their muscles. All right, so that only leaves the distal epiphysis for us. Here are some very smooth surfaces for articulation. What's the general word you would use to name a smooth surface for articulation? There is a smooth surface on the mandible that articulates, helps make the TMJ. Ah, condyle. Perfect, perfect, perfect. So here are a couple condyles, right? They're raised areas. They're nice and smooth, but they have a particular shape and orientation, so they have some special names. But nonetheless, they are condyles. All right, so what side of the humerus is this one over here, medial or lateral? Lateral. The lateral one kind of looks like a marble. We're going to call that the capitulum. I think I mentioned that last time before we started really talking about bones, some important landmarks. All right, capitulum. And then the one that kind of looks like a spool you would wrap some twine or thread on, right, this is called the trochlea. So there are two different kinds of articulating surfaces, and that gives you a hint. How many bones do you think there are in the forearm that attach here?
Two.
Yeah, there are two, because you have these two articulating surfaces. When we get to the forearm, you're going to see that there are two bones. There's one bone that is going to be medial that attaches to the trochlea. There's one over here that's going to attach to the capitulum, and that is the lateral bone in the forearm. Okay. Above these condylar surfaces, we have some bony prominences, right? So here's the medial epicondyle. Epi means on top, and you told me this is a condyle. The trochlea is a condyle, right? Here is the lateral epicondyle, and there's a little ridge. I don't think in lab we ask you to know this supracondylar ridge, right? But it's an epicondyle. And what are these epicondyles for? They're a process. Muscle attachment. Yeah, we're going to look at some muscles in the forearm eventually, sooner or later. All right, so when we look at this humerus in this projection right here, would you say this is anterior or posterior? I would like for you to see it to be anterior. A nice giveaway is this, what? Intertubercular sulcus. That's going to be anterior. All right, and I also see a couple depressions. Ooh, what's a depression called again? A fossa, yeah, a fossa. Okay, this lateral one over here is called the radial fossa, right? It's called the radial fossa because the head of the bone that articulates with the capitulum, when you bend your elbow like that, it's got to have a place to go. Otherwise, it would break. So it fits into this depression right here, right? And we call that the radial fossa. And so now you could tell me the name of the bone in the forearm that is lateral, right? You agree this is the lateral side of the humerus? That bone fits into the radial fossa. The name of that bone is the radius, right? Just like when we name processes on bones in the skull, right? You had the zygomatic process. Now, was the zygomatic process on the zygomatic bone or temporal bone? Temporal bone, right? So we don't want to call this the humeral fossa. We want to call this the radial fossa because that's the bone that fits in right here, sort of like that same nomenclature. All right, there's one that's medial to the radial fossa. This is what we call the coronoid fossa. And there is a process on the bone that is medial called the coronoid process, which we're going to see in a second. And when you bend your elbow like that, it's a big, powerful process. It has to have a place to go, and it fits into this fossa right here. And that's going to be called the coronoid process when we get to it. All right, I think we got to look at a posterior view of the humerus. Oh, I can see what the anatomic neck very nicely right here. Now I can see it on this orientation. I can see, and the, even the surgical neck is shown. Okay, and so what side of the bone do I have the cursor on now? Medial, right, because here's the head. Here is the lateral side, right, because there's that deltoid tuberosity and the head is pointing the other way. All right, so I wanted you to get oriented because I see a nice condylar surface. And you just told me this is medial and this is lateral. What was the name of that medial condylar surface that we saw on this anterior view? What was the medial one called? I see it right here, trochlea. Kind of looks like this little bobbin. Let's go back to the posterior view. This is what it looks like from the back. All right, so here is the trochlea looking from the back. And notice that I don't see really the capitulum at all right here. It's just kind of missing. I just see the trochlea. But one thing that is noteworthy is this really huge depression. That's a fossa, right? And we're going to call that the olecranon fossa because there's another really big process on a bone in your forearm. And I'm banging it right now on the tabletop. This thing right here that's pointing out that we think consider really our elbow, that's called the olecranon process, right? And when you straighten your arm out, where does that process go? It disappears. It's got to disappear someplace without breaking something. It disappears into the olecranon fossa, right? So can you all feel that olecranon process right there when you bend your elbow, straighten your arm out? Ah, it kind of disappears, right? It fits into this olecranon fossa. And then I can see the epicondyles again for muscle attachment. All right, so the elbow is a little bit tricky because there's some really important parts to it. You've never used capitulum before or trochlea before in your life. I don't think so. Has anybody ever used these terms? Like we've used collarbone before, right, things like that. But I've never used capitulum and trochlea. So you got to spend a little bit of time. Capitulum is lateral. Trochlea is medial. When we flip it around, we only see that medial part over here, right? And so let's look at the bones that help make this joint. Okay, let's look at the bones first. So here are the two bones. You already told me that there are two bones in the forearm. The lateral one, I think you told me already, is the radius, because when you bend your elbow, the head of the radius right here has to fit into the radial fossa on the humerus, all right? So when you bend your elbow, the head of the radius is fitting into the radial fossa. What side of the humerus is that radial fossa on, anterior or posterior? It's going to be on the anterior side, right? Anterior side. Okay, so here is the radius. The radius is the lateral bone in your forearm. So you have to memorize that, but there might be another way that some of you will be able to memorize that. Sometimes when you want to count somebody's heart rate and feel their pulse, where can you feel somebody's pulse pretty easily? Okay? I like to feel their pulse in their wrist. Okay? And when you feel a pulse, is it medial or lateral? And as a matter of fact, am I in anatomic position right now? Yeah, so we can make sense when we talk about it, right? So where do we palpate for a pulse? Laterally, right above your thumb, right? And some of you might actually call that the radial pulse. Has anyone ever called that the radial pulse? Maybe you've run into that if you ever worked in a hospital or lab or something. Radial pulse, because that pulse right there is associated with what bone? The radius, right? And so the name of that blood vessel is called the radial artery, hence the radial pulse, which is lateral. So So radius is lateral in the forearm, which means that the other bone is going to be medial. And the name of the other bone is the ulna. Here it is right here. And there's a little bit of a ligament between them called the interosseous membrane. It sort of stabilizes these two bones, but it doesn't really restrict their motion. It holds them into place kind of loosely. It's not a very tight joint, not like a suture. Right, sutures in the skull really hold the bones of the skull together. Not so much with this interosseous membrane. Okay. All right. Well, we talked about the point of your elbow, big massive bone right there. We said that is the olecranon process, and it's kind of like a hook. Can't see the whole hook aspect, right? But it's posterior on the ulna, and when you straighten your elbow out, this big process has to fit into the olecranon fossa. All right. So when you straighten your elbow out, that olecranon process disappears into the olecranon fossa. What side of the humerus is the olecranon fossa on? Anterior or posterior? Yeah, it's going to be posterior side. Sooner or later, you might be able to see all that, right? Posterior side. There is another lip down over here, which is a process. This is what we call the coronoid process. So when you bend your elbow, this big process right here has to fit into a depression on the anterior side of the humerus that we call the coronoid fossa. Right, so you got the radial fossa and the coronoid fossa on the humerus, which are anterior because this is a nice anterior view of the radius and ulna. So radius is lateral, ulna is medial. Usually students don't have a lot of trouble remembering which is which. In the leg, it's a little bit different. We're going to talk about the leg. All right, so we got the head of the radius, the neck of the radius. Probably you would have been able to tell me that. And then a tuberosity, which is a process. What do you think the function of this radial tuberosity is? Muscle attachment. Yep, muscle attachment. All right, the same thing for the coronoid process and the olecranon process. There are really big, important muscles that attach to these things, so these bones have to enlarge, get strong, get bigger. All right, so here is a nice zoomed in region of the elbow that we've been talking about. So right on the top of this diagram, we see the humerus, right? And I see the end of the humerus. What end of the humerus is this right here? Let's use that terminology. Distal, I like distal. Distal what? Distal epiphysis. Yeah, distal epiphysis, right? And I can see some nice structures. I can see this thing that looks like a marble, and that's the capitulum. Can you remember what side this is on? Is that medial or lateral? Lateral. Capitulum is lateral. And then medial, this condylar surface is called the trochlea. All right, so remember the lateral bone in the forearm is the radius. So when you bend your elbow, the head of the radius has to fit into a nice depression, which is this right here, which is what we're going to call the... It's not labeled. Ha, ha, ha. Here's one that's not labeled on your slide. This is the radial depression, but we don't call it a depression. Call that the fossa, radial fossa. Okay. And since this is a coronoid process on the ulna, which is medial, here is the coronoid fossa. Can you see that if you bend your elbow, these things have to fit into these different pockets right here? Okay, so they're important. You can also see the epicondyles. And here's that radial tuberosity on the radius. So here's lateral, medial, and then the posterior view now shows you very nicely when you straighten your elbow out, this big olecranon process has to fit into the olecranon fossa, and I think you should have a sense that this is olecranon fossa is on the posterior side of the humerus. Okay? All right, so that's something about that elbow joint. Let's look in particular at some of the features of these bones in the forearm. All right, so here is a thumb. Is that thumb medial or lateral for you? As a matter of fact, for everybody, it is lateral, right? And the lateral bone in the forearm is the radius. The medial one is the ulna. And so we're looking at this medial one, right? So are you oriented a little bit? So here's the proximal epiphysis of the ulna. Here is that big bony elbow point that sticks out in your elbow. That's what we call the olecranon process. And now you can see the coronoid process. Right? You couldn't really see it before because you're looking right down on top of it. So here's the coronoid process, and you see this hook. You see this little hook right here? That's what we call the trochlear notch, because what fits in the trochlear notch? The trochlea, right? So it seems complicated, but once you get a feel for how things are named, I think it will come together for you. Okay, the trochlea fits in the trochlear notch of the ulna. Okay. The other thing that I notice, let me flip back a couple slides right here. Yeah. Notice the head of the radius. Do you believe me? This is the head of the radius right here. Right? And it looks really nice and round. Is touching the ulna. Right? So here's the ulna. Can you see that they're touching? So this is a joint. Right? A connection between two bones is a joint or an articulation. So let's take a look at this joint, at least in terms of what it looks like on the ulna. Here is part of that joint. And it's a depression. You could call it a fossa, but most people call it a notch. And since the head of the radius fits into this notch on the ulna, we call this the radial notch. Okay? So again, remember, we don't name this feature by the name of the bone that it's on, but by the name of the bone that it is associating with, which is the radius. And we don't want to call this the radial fossa, because then you'd get confused with what? This depression over here. Here's the radial fossa. Here's the radial notch. All right, so the head of the radius can rotate very nicely right inside this radial notch, trochlear notch. Okay. Anybody have any questions on this? I went over a lot of material. It didn't seem fast, but I know it was fast, even though maybe it didn't seem like it. Any questions on this? Squirrel this over here?
Yeah.
Okay. Upper, yeah, right in through here. Okay, and we're going to get to pelvic girdle pretty soon. Got to talk about a couple other bones. All right, so that elbow is going to make a whole lot more sense next week, when you can actually grab these bones, turn them around, put them on your body the way they're supposed to fit, put them together, right, and just name all of these things, because right now you're just looking at these pictures and you're hearing me speak about them, but you actually need to view these things in three dimensions, and you'll have a much better appreciation for what's going on. All right, so here we have the distal end of the radius and the ulna, and let's look at this expanded view of the radius. Do you believe me that this is the radius? How could you convince me that where I have the cursor right now is the radius bone? Because, you see the thumb. And in an anatomic position, the thumb is lateral, right? So that's a really nice thing to observe. And so here is the radius. Now notice, which bone has a more massive distal epiphysis, the radius or the ulna? The radius is really big. All right, and as a matter of fact, if you look at the ulna, it sort of looks like the head of the radius, but just a little bit smaller, right? It's still round, and indeed, we're going to call that the head of the ulna. Head of the radius is proximal. Head of the ulna is distal. It's just the way it goes. All right, so here is the head of the ulna, right? Even though it kind of looks like the head of the radius, it's really the ulna, right? We take this ulna, put it out over here. And notice that there is an articulation between the radius and the ulna right over here. That kind of reminds me of the articulation between the head of the radius and the ulna, which is up over here. What did we call this depression in the ulna? That was the radial notch, right? Because it was a notch in the ulna. All right, so here is ulna, here is radius, and look, here is a notch in the radius. Do we want to call this the radial notch? We want to name it by what bone associates with this particular structure, and it is the ulna. So here's the ulna. The ulna associates with the ulnar notch in what bone? The ulnar notch in the radius. I know it's really, I'm using a lot of words, sounds really wordy, but the convention, I think, once you see it, will be really helpful for you. Okay, so here is the ulnar notch in the radius. And this one up over here is going to be the radial notch in the ulna. Okay. Those are the kinds of joints, along with the capitulum over here, which allows you, without even bending your elbow, to have your palms facing anteriorly, or you can have your palms facing posteriorly. Those heads have to rotate in those various joints so that you can do that. And when that happens, the radius actually crosses over the top of the ulna. And we're going to learn what these motions are in just a little bit. So that's why that joint right there in the elbow looks pretty complicated, because that's a really nifty motion that you can do right there with the elbow. The other motion, what's another motion you could do with the elbow? Up and down, right? We call that flexion and extension. So I'll just start to mention it. So you got flexion, extension, okay? Pronation is like that. Supination is moving like this. Well, we'll learn those motions in a little bit, but it's okay if you hear them right now. So there's four important motions that can happen at the elbow, which is up over here. All right, so what do we got? We talked about the humerus. What are parts of the appendicular skeleton proximal to the humerus? Not shown on this slide. What bones do we talk about? What attaches this upper appendage to your axial skeleton? You could call it the pectoral girdle. What bones make up the pectoral girdle? Scapula and clavicle. You don't see it here, but don't forget, they're really there. So you got clavicle, scapula, posterior, humerus, laterally in the forearm, you got radius, medially the ulna, which leaves us with what? Things that are down over here. The first thing that we run into is your wrist. The second thing we run into is your hand. The third thing we run into, the most distal part, is going to be your digits. You could call it a finger, but typically we call them digits. And all of these structures have bones. So since we're in the skeletal system, we're going to look at these bones. Okay. All right, so this just shows some nice plain radiographs. All right, so what part, which bone is more prominent, bigger and thicker in your wrist, which is going to be, it's going to be the distal end of the radius or distal end of the ulna. Which one is bigger and thicker? The radius, right? And you can see it right here, right? Because here's your thumb, which is lateral, which means here is the radius. Look how big that radius is compared to the head of the ulna. One thing I didn't mention. See this little process right here sticking off right there? That's called a styloid process. This over here on the radius, that's called styloid process as well. All right, and that just helps stabilize the wrist. Maybe I missed it on those diagrams, but in lab, we'll look at these things. Those are nice landmarks. They're easy landmarks to pick up. Okay, so we said we have forearm, we have wrist, we have hand, and digits. And you see that they're different kinds of bones. So let's look at the wrist. All right, so the wrist has a bunch of short bones in there. There are eight of them. And I'm not going to have you know all eight, even though this is an anatomy class. I'm going to have you know one, but I want you to know what all of these bones in the wrist are called as a group. They form a group, and that group of bones are what we call carpals. Okay, so carpals make up your wrist. There's one bone that I want you to know, and it is right underneath, right distal to this big bony part of the radius, right, and that's called the scaphoid. Yeah, I can't see it on this diagram very well, but there's a really thin part of the scaphoid, kind of makes a little hook. Okay, makes a little hook. And when people fall, when you fall, what do you like to do before you, like, bash your nose into the ground? Yeah, you like to put your hand down. Fall backwards, you put your hand down. Okay, and when that happens, your wrist pushes up against the radius with a lot of force. And what do you think is stronger, the scaphoid or the radius? The radius is bigger and stronger, so the scaphoid has a tendency to fracture whenever you fall, especially because it gets really narrow in a certain region right here. There's a blood vessel that gets damaged that brings oxygen and nutrients to the scaphoid, and a lot of times that blood vessel doesn't regenerate or it is partially occluded. And what can you tell me about the scaphoid? Is it living tissue or is it just like a stone? It's living tissue. And what happens to living tissue when you cut off blood supply? Yeah, it dies, right? So a lot of times when people have a wrist injury, the scaphoid is broken and it doesn't grow back, unfortunately. Right? And then what happens when you change the structure of the wrist? You take that scaphoid out. you change the function of the wrist as well, right? So a real simple kind of fall can cause problems later on. There's other bad fractures that can happen in this region, but that's a pretty common one. So that's why I want you to know that this proximal lateral bone of the wrist, it's a carpal, and the specific name is scaphoid. All right, so here's the scaphoid. So there are two rows of four bones. This one over here you have to know is the scaphoid. So these are all, what do we call all the wrist bones together? Those are carpals. All right, so now we're going to move into the hand. Tell you what, take a look at your own body. Where's your wrist at? Can you see where your wrist is? Yeah, because you can palpate where your ulna and radius is. So here's your wrist. All right, so here's your wrist. And then what do you got distal to your wrist? What's this part right here? Yeah, it's the palm of your hand. There are some bones in there, long bones, and we see them right here. Okay. And these are what we're going to call metacarpals. So here are metacarpals make up what part of your body? Your hand, or the palm of your hand. Carpals make up your wrist. Well, I'm not sure that's really obvious unless you look at your own body. Now, we don't have specific names for metacarpals. We just give them numbers. And of course, if you're going to talk about them, you should probably say right or left as well, of course. Right? But, and each of them have a number, right? 1 through 5. Every once in a while, you might find more or less, right? But that's pretty typical, 1 through 5. And number 1 is on what digit? Just an everyday language, your thumb, right? So your number 1 digit is your thumb. And the number 1 metacarpal is the one that attaches what is going to be lateral, right? Number 5 is going to be medial. And that's how you would number them. So on a practicum, if I had an arrow pointing right here, and I would say, what's the name of this bone? You would say, metacarpal number 3. Okay? And I'm not going to ask you for right or left, but you'd probably be able to tell, because it's easy to tell anterior from posterior in the hand. Okay? All right, so we got carpals, metacarpals, and then we have bones that make up, what did we call these things? Yeah, we call them fingers, but not really so much in anatomy. We call them digits, right? And so here is a digit. Here is your index finger, right? How many bones do you see in this particular digit? I see 3, right? I see a proximal, middle, and distal. And what digit is this number? It is number 2, right? So here's digit number 2. So digit number 2 has 3 phalanges, right? So here's the proximal. Oh, you don't see what we call a singular bone is. A singular bone here is called a phalanx. Right, so phalanx, if we talk about plural, these are phalanges. So digits number 2, 3, 4, and 5 all have the same number of phalanges, which is, if we look at digit number 5, your little finger, okay, excuse that little nomenclature right there, has how many phalanges? Proximal, middle, distal. Okay. What about digit number 1? It has proximal and distal, and that's it. Don't be confused with this middle bone right here. Sometimes students will call this the medial. They'll call this one right here the number 4 medial phalanx. But what does medial mean? It doesn't make sense. Medial means toward midline, right? This bone is not medial, not lateral. It is in the middle. All right, so middle and medial really don't mean the same thing. So just kind of get that straightened out. All right, so this is really simple nomenclature, and sometimes the simpler it is, the easier it is to forget because it just seems so simple. So number 1 digit is your thumb, right? Okay, and that's how you're just going to count 1 through 5. Here is something, all right, a sesamoid bone. This is another, I think this is about the only other location I know where you have a sesamoid bone. It's a bone that's completely surrounded by a tendon. I don't think you can really palpate that thing because you have a big, strong muscle in front of it. And these things really belong right there. You can have sesamoid bones and other tendons in your body, but those usually develop because of some inflammatory process. So that's not normal, but these are normal. Does anybody know the name of another sesamoid bone? We talked about it, not extensively, but we're going to talk about it coming up next. It is the patella, right, in your lower appendage. That's a sesamoid bone, another kind of sesamoid bone. All right, so now you got to stop me and ask me some questions. Because we're done. We're completely done with the upper appendage. What did we start with? Pectoral girdle, clavicle scapula, then humerus, and then radius, ulna, and we looked at some details of those bones, and then the carpals, metacarpals, phalanges. All right. How many of the carpals do you have to know? Just one. And the name of that one is the scaphoid. Okay, raise your hand if you feel really bad, like you're getting gypped out of something, if you're only going to know one of the carpals. You do? Okay. We'll talk about it more in lab. Okay, because it's an important joint, very important joint. Okay. But on the test, and even on the practicum, right, I'll only ask you this one right here. Okay, and I tell you what, if you want to know the names of all of these bones, there is something that you can use to help remember the orientation and the arrangement and the names of these bones, and it is called a mnemonic, right? And there's a website called medicalmnemonics.com, and if you just take the first letter of each of these bones right here and make another word, link them together in a sentence, then the sentence will help, will sort of make sense, and you can remember the names of all these different bones. Sort of like IPMAP for mitosis, but that's not a sentence, right? A mnemonic is a little bit more sophisticated than that. All right, so that is the upper appendage. So what are you ready for now? The lower appendage. All right, okay, lower appendage, okay. So the lower appendage has to hold up a lot more weight, move a lot more weight in your body. So what do you think about those bones in the lower appendage? What about those muscles in the lower appendage? Bigger and stronger, right? Exactly right. Okay, so here is the pelvic girdle. It's made up of two bones, and those bones are what we call an os-coxae. So here's one os-coxae, here is the second. And right smack in the middle, what do we have right smack in the middle? The sacrum, right? And so here is sort of an interesting illustration, because what part of the skeleton is this? Axial or appendicular? Axial. You said axial because what did you see? You saw the sacrum. And other people said appendicular because you see the os-coxae. Right, so here is an illustration that's made up of part axial skeleton, part appendicular skeleton, right? Because we said the vertebral column is part of the axial skeleton, right? So don't forget this sacrum right here, even though it makes something that we call the pelvis, right, it is still part of the axial skeleton. So here's the sacrum, and of course the coccyx, that's part of your axial skeleton too. Okay, so an os-coxae at one time was actually three bones that fused together. Right? And the first bone, which is superior, is the ilium. The one that is anterior is the pubis. And the one that you all are sitting on is the ischium. So these are three bones that make up an os-coxae. And I'm going to show you a couple really good orientations of this. So when you have an os-coxae in lab that's not making a pelvis like this, you got to pick it up. You got to turn it around. You got to put it on your body, how it fits, right? And it's going to fit only in one orientation. And then you'll have a much better idea of this os-coxae, because this is probably the most complicated bone to have a nice picture of in your mind. So here's the joint between the ilium and the sacrum. Well, how would we want to call this joint right here? Okay, this joint right here is called the iliosacral joint. Right, so iliosacral, join them together with an O. Okay, now, there is a depression right here. This is called the acetabulum. Oh, it's labeled over here, acetabulum. It's a very deep depression. What was the corresponding depression on the scapula that kind of reminds you of this acetabulum? I didn't lead you into that thought very well. Okay, there is a bone in the thigh that attaches right here at the acetabulum, and that's called the femur. The head of the femur attaches to the acetabulum. So my question was, the head of the humerus attaches to what depression in the scapula? It was the glenoid fossa, right? So So the glenoid fossa is something we find on the scapula. The acetabulum is what we find on the ascoxane. And just like on the scapula, which way was that glenoid fossa pointing, medial or lateral? Lateral. So which way is the acetabulum facing? Lateral as well. That's going to be a really important landmark. Okay. Another important landmark is going to be this iliac crest. You can feel the top of your hip bone right there, so you know that's superior, maybe a little bit posterior, right? But that's superior. You know the acetabulum is lateral. That will help you orient yourself to this really strangely shaped bone. Okay, what else do I want to say with this slide? Probably not so much. Maybe I'll come back to it in a little bit. Guess what we have right here? This is the ascoxane, and it looks weird. And you're going to have to practice with this one in lab. And on this illustration, this is an exam figure. All right, and I see the acetabulum right here. So is this a nice lateral or medial view of an ascoxane? Nice lateral, right? Because here's the acetabulum. And remember I said that this ascoxane was actually three bones during development that had fused together. The superior one is the ilium. And can you see this margin right here? Okay, so above that is the ilium. And then inferior to it is the ischium. And then I can see it ending right here. This is the anterior, the most anterior part. This is the pubis. You can kind of palpate that one too. Okay, so pubis. The three bones of the ascoxae, ilium, ischium, pubis. Pubis is anterior. All right, I see some notches. Here's a really big notch. And so we're going to call that the greater sciatic notch. There's one below it over here, that is the lesser sciatic notch. And here is a process for muscle attachment. It's kind of long and narrow, so we call that the spine. The spine is between the greater and lesser sciatic notches. And what bone is this spine on? Is it the ilium, ischium, or pubis? Ischium, so we call that the ischial spine. There's only one ischial spine. Okay, and it's going to be really easy to see behind, right between these sciatic notches. When we look at the ilium right here, it sort of makes a fan. And when we looked at a sacrum in lab, the sacrum has a fan-shaped aspect to it. We call that the ala, so fan or wing. So here is the ala of the ilium. Big importance, very strong muscles attached to that. That's why this is such a big bone. Here is the iliac crest, attachment point to many muscles. And then here are some processes. One, two, three, four. So one, two, three, four. These processes, what bone are they on? They're all on the ilium. This one down here was on the ischium. But these four are on the ilium. So these are what we're going to call iliac spines. But of course, there's four of them. They've got to have four different names. What did we say about the pubis? Anterior, posterior, superior, anterior. Right, so here's anterior. Here are a couple of processes on the ilium. These are anterior processes. One is on top of the other, so here is the anterior superior iliac spine. Sounds a little wordy, but it describes this process exactly. You could call it superior anterior iliac spine, that's fine, right? Then this one over here would be the anterior inferior iliac spine. So if this is anterior, what side of the ascoxae is this? Posterior. So here's the posterior superior iliac spine. Here is the posterior inferior iliac spine. Okay. And we see these nicely on what kind of view? A nice lateral view. Okay. Something that you can't tell very easily, okay, is the depth of the acetabulum. Oh, notice that the ilium, ischium, and pubis all join together right here in an acetabulum. If we get a real ascoxae out, you'll be able to see these lines of fusion pretty nice right in the acetabulum. Okay, this acetabulum is very deep, right? It's a really nice, deep fossa. It's almost like a cup. Okay, well, how deep was that glenoid fossa? Do you have a picture of that? I don't want to flip back because I might get seasick flipping back really fast. How deep was that glenoid fossa? You know what? I might have to go back. Let me go back. Okay. Here is that glenoid fossa. glenoid cavity. Does it look like a big, deep bowl? It almost looks flat to me. Kind of looks more like a saucer, right? Bless you. Right? It doesn't look very deep. But if we look at that acetabulum right here, all right, I never measured it, but I would say it's probably 5 or 6 times as deep, maybe even more than that. All right, so this is a really big bowl that the head of the femur fits into. All right, well, what does that mean? Which joint do you think is stronger? The one that has a very shallow cavity or one that has a very deep cavity so the head fits deep inside the bone that it's joining to? Yeah, the deep one, right? So the hip joint is very strong because the acetabulum is very deep. So the femur can fit very deeply inside the acetabulum, but the humerus, not so much, right? It just sits in that very shallow depression. So the humerus, so the shoulder joint is not very strong compared to the hip joint. All right, but remember, when we were talking about different microscopes, some microscopes were good at one thing, which meant that they were not so good at other things. And then we could find a microscope that were good in those other things, but then it wasn't so good with the first thing that we talked about. Okay, so we call that a trade-off. All right, so let's talk about the trade-off between the shoulder and the hip. Right, this hip joint is really strong. That's good because it's holding up a lot of weight, but it means it's not very mobile. It's not very dexterous. You can't do a lot of things with your hip. Your shoulder joint, on the other hand, is not very strong, but what can you do with your shoulder joint? Well, you can do all kinds of things, right? You can raise your hand up, you can put it down, in front of you, behind you, all of that kind of stuff. All right, so the shoulder joint is not very strong, but it gives you a greater range of motion. So strength is traded off with range of motion. The hip joint just doesn't have that same range of motion, but that's okay because we like for that joint to be as strong as possible. All right, what are some other things? Well, here is that ischium. This is the part of the ischium that we're sitting on. There's some really important strong muscles that attach here. We call this the ischial tuberosity. So here's the body of the ischium. Here is a part that's making a 90-degree bend to the body of the ischium. So we call that the ramus, ischial ramus. Here is the body of the pubic bone, and it makes a 90-degree bend. Here is the ramus of the pubic bone. So here's the inferior ramus, and then here's the superior ramus as well. It's got a superior and inferior. And you know what? I think I've talked about just about everything on this very complicated bone, at least from this nice lateral view. Let's look at the medial view. All right, I tell you what, before we go, what do we call this fan-shaped structure once again? That is the ala. Okay. If we go to the medial view, do you still see that fan-shaped structure? To me, I still see something that looks like a fan. Right, so this is really still the ala, but if you look at a nice medial view, you see that there's a depression here as well. What do you call a depression in anatomy? Fossa, and it's on the iliac bone. So here is the iliac fossa, and of course that's holding important abdominal and pelvic organs. That's why it's there, right? And it's just the medial side of that ala that forms this fan. So I can see the iliac crest once again, and When we look at pubis, what are we going to think of? Anterior, posterior, superior, how are we going to think of that? Pubis is anterior. So here I see a couple spines on the ilium. So are these going to be anterior or posterior? These are anterior spines, right? So here is the superior, here's the inferior, anterior iliac spines, and then here are the posterior ones, superior and inferior. Okay. And between the greater and lesser sciatic notches is the ischial spine. All right, so I mention all these spines together because it's easy to confuse this ischial spine with the iliac spines. Until you see it, then it's not such a big deal. There's only one ischial spine easily located because it's between the sciatic notches. Here is a hole in the acetabulum. That's the obturator foramen. What else do I want to say about this? This line, can you see? I can almost see a little line right here. That's the arcuate line. That's going to be important because it's going to define something we call the pelvis. There's something called a true pelvis and a false pelvis, which we got to talk about next time because, oh, it's a zero. Now, I thought it was eight after. It's not eight after. It's just zero. Okay? Nonetheless. Okay, appendicular skeleton, we still got to cover the femur. Okay, two bones in the leg and then the foot, but these are going to be very similar to what we learned about in terms of the humor. So we laid a lot of groundwork already for understanding these. So next time I'll go over these pretty quick before we get into joints. Now, the joint chapter is kind of challenging because it's more like physiology and less like anatomy, because joints have different kinds of motions. And we classify joints by their function, and function is what? Function is physiology. Yeah, so be prepared to have like mind twisters next time because we're going to talk about something more like physiology. All right, sign-in sheet is going around. Go ahead, sign that sign-in sheet, please.